A hand-lettered sign announced Holes Dug and Odd Jobs. There was not a buyer in sight. I didn't even catch sight of any residents. A United States flag flew from a hand-rigged pole, and I could see state flags as well, all snapping in a hot wind that whipped up the dust. Here there were no TV antennas, no fences, no telephone poles, no power lines, no permanent structures of any kind. The whole place had a gypsy air, vari-colored awnings offering protection from the midday sun. The silence was broken by an occasional barking dog. I pulled over to the side of the road and parked my car, getting out. I shaded my eyes and scanned the area. Now that my eyes had adjusted to the harsh light, I could see that there were actually people in view. A couple sitting in the open doorway of their mobile home. A lone man passing from one aisle of vehicles to the next. No one seemed to pay any attention to me. The arrival and departure of strangers was apparently so commonplace that my presence elicited no interest whatever. About 50 yards away, I spotted a woman sitting in a rectangle of shade formed by a bright red and orange parachute that had been strung up between two campers. She was nursing a baby, her face bent to the side of the infant. I approached, stopping about 15 feet away. I wasn't sure what constituted personal turf out here, and I didn't want to trespass. "Hi," I said. "I wonder if you could give me some help." She looked up at me. She might have been 18. Her dark hair was pulled up in a ragged knot on top of her head. She wore shorts and a cotton shirt, unbuttoned down the front. The baby worked with such vigor that I could hear the sucking noise from where I stood. "You looking for Eddie?" I shook my head. "I'm trying to find a woman named Agnes Gray. Do you happen to know her?" "Nuh-uh. Eddie might. He's been out here a lot longer than me. Is she permanent?" "I understand she's been out here for years." "Then you might check at the Christian Center down here on the left. Trailer with a sign out listing all the activities. Lot of people register with them in case of emergency." "What did you want her for?" "She has a daughter up in Santa Teresa who hasn't heard from her for months. She asked me to find out why her mother hasn't been in touch." She squinted at me.
"You some kind of detective?"
"Well, yeah, more or less. I'm a friend of the family, and I was down in this area anyway, so I said I'd check it out." I took out the two snapshots Irene Gersh had given me. I moved over and held them out so she could see. "This is her trailer. I don't have a picture of her. She's an old woman, in her 80s. The girl tilted her head, looking at the photographs.
"Oh, yeah, that one. I know her. I never heard her real name. Everybody calls her Old Mama."
"Can you tell me where to find her?"
"Not really. I can tell you where her trailer's at, but I haven't seen her for a while."
"Do you remember when you saw her last?" She thought about it briefly, screwing up her face.
"I never paid much attention, so I can't really say. She goes stumping up and down out here when she needs a ride into town. Everybody's real good about that, if your car's broke or something and you gotta have a lift. She's kind of weird, though."
"Like what?"
"Oh, well, you know, she has these spells when she talks to herself. You see people like that jabbering away, making gestures like they're in the middle of an argument. Eddie took her into Brawley a couple times, and he said she was all right then. Smelled bad, but she wasn't out of her head or anything like that."
"You haven't seen her lately?"
"No, but she's probably still around someplace. I've been busy with the baby. You might ask somebody else. I never talked to her myself."
"What about Eddie? When do you expect him back?"
"Not till 5, I think he said. If you want to check her trailer, go down this road about a quarter mile. You'll see this old rusted-out Chevy. That's called Rusted-Out Chevy Road. Turn right and drive till you pass these concrete bunker things on the left. They look like ewes. I don't know what they are, but her trailer's in the next lot. Just bang on the door loud. I don't think she hears good from what Eddie said."
"Thanks, I'll do that."
"If you don't find her, you can come on back here and wait for him if you like. He might know more."
I glanced at my watch. It was just 12:25. "I may do that," I said. "Thanks for the help."
End of Disc 1. Disc 2.
Chapter 4. The trailer on rusted-out Chevy Road was a sorry sight, bearing very little resemblance to the snapshot I had in my possession, which showed an old but sturdy-looking travel trailer, painted flat blue, sitting on four black-wall tires. From the picture, I estimated that it was 30-some years old, built in the days when it might have been hitched to the back of a Buick sedan and hauled halfway across the country. Now spray paint had been used to emblazon the siding with the sort of words my aunt urged me to hold to a minimum. Some of the louvers on the windows had been broken out, and the door was hanging on one hinge. As I drove by, I saw a unisex person, approximately 12 years of age, sitting on the doorsill in ragged cutoffs, hair in dreadlocks, finger up its nose, apparently mining the contents. I passed the place, did a U-turn, and doubled back, pulling over to the side of the road in front. By the time I got out, the doorsill was deserted. I knocked on the door frame. "Hello?" I sang. Nothing. "Hello?" I peered in. The place was empty, at least the portion I could see. The interior, which had probably never been clean, was littered now with trash. Empty bottles and cans were discarded in a heap where a fold-down table should have been. Dust coated most surfaces. The banquette on the right looked like it had been chopped up for firewood. The doors on the kitchen cabinets had all been removed. Cupboards were empty. The tiny four-burner butane-fueled stove looked like it hadn't been used for months. I glanced to my left, moving down a short passage that led to a small bedroom in the back. A door on the right opened onto a bathroom, which consisted of a defunct chemical toilet, a ragged hole in the wall where a basin had once been attached, and a length of pipe sticking out above a shower pan filled with rags. The bedroom contained a bare mattress and two sleeping bags zipped together and left in a wad. Someone was living here, and I didn't think it was Irene Gersh's mom. I peered through the window, but all I saw outside was a buff-colored stretch of desert with a low range of mountains 10 or 15 miles away. Distances are deceptive out here because there aren't any reference points. I picked my way back to the front door and stepped out, circling the trailer. Around the corner, a bucket lined with a plastic bag served as a makeshift outhouse. There were several bags like it, tied at the top and tossed together in a pile. A black fly manufacturing plant. Across the road, there was a concrete pad where a Winnebago was moored. Beside the RV, there was a pickup truck mounted with a camper shell. The pad itself was cracked, weeds growing up through the crevices. A Weber grill had been set out, and the smell of charcoal lighter and smoking briquettes drifted across the road to me. Near the grill, there was a folding table surrounded by mismatched chrome chairs. As I crossed the road, a woman emerged from the trailer carrying a tray loaded with a foil-covered plate, condiments, and utensils. She was in her 40s, slim, with a long, weathered face. No makeup, salt-and-pepper hair cropped short. She wore blue jeans and a flannel shirt, both faded to a pale gray. She went about her business, ignoring my approach. I watched her put 5 fat hamburger patties on the grill. She moved over to the table and began to set it with forks and paper plates. "Excuse me," I said. "Do you know the woman who lives over there?" "You're related?" "I'm a friend of the family." "About time somebody took an interest," she said snappishly. "What's going on over there is a low-down disgrace." "What is going on over there?" "Kids moved in. You can see they trashed the place. Loud parties, loud arguments, fights breaking out. We all make it a point to mind our own business out here, but there's limits." "What about Agnes? What happened to her? Surely she's not still living there." The woman cocked a head toward the Winnebago. "Marcus, you want to come out here, please? Woman's asking about old Mama." The door to the Winnebago opened, and a man peered out. He was of medium height, small-boned, with warm skin tones, suggesting Mediterranean origins. His hair was dark, combed back from his face. His nose was short and straight, his lips very full. His dark eyes were fringed with black lashes. He looked like a male model in an Italian menswear ad. He stared at me for a moment, his expression neutral. "Who are you?" he asked. No accent. He wore pleated pants and the sort of ribbed undershirt old men wear. "I'm Kinsey," I said. "Agnes Gray's daughter asked me to drive out here and check on her. Do you have any idea where she is?" He surprised me by holding out his hand to introduce himself. We shook. His palm was soft and hot, his grip firm.
I'm Marcus. This is my wife, Faye. We haven't seen old Mama for a long time. Like months. We heard she got sick, but I don't know for sure. Hospital in Brawley. You might see if she's there.
Wouldn't somebody have notified her relatives? Marcus stuck his hands in his pockets with a shrug.
She might not have told them. This is the first I knew she had family. She's a real private person. Like a recluse, almost. Minds her own business as long as you mind yours. Where's this daughter live?
Santa Teresa. She's been worried about Agnes, but she didn't have a way to get in touch.
Neither of them seemed impressed with the sincerity of Irene's concern. I changed the subject, looking back at the trailer across the road.
Who's the little gremlin I saw sitting on the front step?
Faye spoke up, her tone sour.
There's two of them, boy and a girl. They came by a few months ago and staked the place out. They must have heard it was empty because they moved in pretty quick. Runaways. Don't know how they survive. Probably stealing or whoring, whichever comes first. We asked them to clean up the sewage, but of course they don't.
Clearly, sewage was a euphemism for the bags of sewage.
The kid I saw couldn't have been 12 years old, I said.
Faye answered, They're 15, boys at any rate. They act like wild animals, and I know they do drugs. They're always picking through our garbage, looking for food. Sometimes other kids come by and camp out with them. Word must be out they have a place to crash.
Can't you report him to the cops?
Marcus shook his head.
Tried that. They vamoose the minute anybody shows up.
Could there be a connection between Agnes's disappearance and their moving in?
I doubt it, he said. She'd been gone a couple months by the time they got here. Somebody might have told them the trailer was empty. They never seemed to worry about her showing up. I know they've torn the place apart, but there's not much we can do.
I gave him my card. This is my number in Santa Teresa. I'll be down here a couple of days seeing if I can get a line on her. After that, you can reach me at this 805 area code. Would you give me a call if she gets in touch? I'll try to check back with you before I leave town in case you've heard from her. Maybe you'll think of something that might be of help.
Faye peered over his shoulder at the card I'd given him.
A private detective? I thought you said you were a family friend.
A hired friend, I said. I had started back to my car when he called my name. I turned and looked at him.
There's a sheriff substation in Island, right next to the old jail on First. You might check with the deputy. There's always a possibility she's dead.
Don't think it hasn't occurred to me, I said. His gaze held mine briefly, and then I moved on.
I headed back toward the township of Nyland, 145 feet below sea level, population 1,200. The old jail is a tiny stucco structure with a shake roof and an ornamental iron wheel attached to the wooden porch rail. Next door, not 10 feet away, is the new jail, housed in the sheriff's substation, also stucco, and not much wider than the width of one door and two windows. An air conditioner hung out of a window around on the side. I parked out in front. A note was taped to the front door. Back at 4 p.m. In emergency or other business, talk to Brawley Depps. Not a clue about how to contact the Brawley Sheriff's Department. I stopped at a gas station, and while the tank was being filled, I found a payphone and checked the dog-eared directory that was chained to the wall, looking up the telephone number of the Brawley Sheriff's Department. From the address listed, I had to guess it wasn't far from my motel on Main. In a quick call, I learned that Sergeant Pokris, the deputy I should be talking to, was presently at lunch and would be back at 1 o'clock. A glance at my watch showed it was 12:50. The sheriff's substation is a one-story stucco building with a red tile roof, located right across the street from the Brawley Police Department. There were two white sheriff's cars parked in the narrow lot. I went in through a glass door. A Pepsi machine dominated the corridor. To the left of the entrance was a closed door that, according to the sign, led to a courtroom. On the other side of the hallway there were two small offices with an open door between them. The interior was polished brown linoleum, formica countertops, light wood desks, metal file cabinets, swivel chairs. There were two deputies and a civilian clerk in sight,
the latter on the telephone. The low murmur of conversation was underscored by the steady, low ratchet of the police radio. Deputy Pokris turned out to be a woman in her 30s, tall and trim, with sandy hair cut short, glasses with tortoiseshell rims. The tan uniform seemed designed for her. All function, no frills. There was very little animation to her face. Her eyes were a penetrating brown, rather cold, and her manner, while not actually rude, was on the abrupt side of businesslike. We didn't waste a lot of time on pleasantries. I stood at the short counter and filled her in on the situation, keeping my account brief and to the point. She listened intently, without comment, and when I finished, she picked up the telephone. She called the local hospital, Pioneers Memorial, and asked for the patient billing and accounting department, her voice warming only slightly in her conversation with someone named Letty on the other end. She pulled a yellow legal pad closer and picked up a pencil sharpened to a perfect point. She made a note, her handwriting full of angular downstrokes. I was sure that, even at the age of 12, she'd never been the type to make a little happy face when she dotted an I. She hung up the phone and used a straight edge to tear off the strip of paper on which she'd written an address. Agnes Gray was admitted to Pioneers on January 5th through emergency after the paramedics picked her up outside a downtown coffee shop where she collapsed. Diagnosis by the admitting physician was pneumonia, malnutrition, acute dehydration, and dementia. On March 2nd, she was transferred to Rio Vista Convalescent Hospital. This is the address. If you locate her, let us know. Otherwise, you can come back in and fill out a missing persons report. We'll do what we can. I glanced at the paper, then folded it and put it in my jeans pocket. I appreciate your help. By the time I got the sentence out, she'd turned away, already back at work on the report she was typing. I used my proffered hand to scratch my nose, feeling the way you do when you wave back at someone who turns out to be waving happily at someone else. On the way to my car, it occurred to me that the admissions officer at the convalescent home might be reluctant to give me information on Agnes Gray. If she was still a patient, I could probably get a room number and whip right in. If she'd been released, things might get trickier. Medical personnel aren't as chatty as they used to be. Too many lawsuits over the right to privacy. Best not blow my chances, I thought. I went back to the vagabond, where I unzipped the duffel and removed my all-purpose dress. I gave it a shake. This faithful garment is the only dress I own, but it goes any place. It's black, collarless, with long sleeves and a zipper down the back, made of some slithery miracle fabric that takes unlimited abuse. You can smush it, wad it up, sit on it, twist it, or roll it in a ball. The instant you release it, the material returns to its original state. I wasn't even sure why I'd brought it. Hoping for a hot night on the town, I suppose. I tossed it on the bed along with my slightly scuffy, low-heeled black shoes and some black pantyhose. I took a 3-minute shower and redid myself. 13 minutes later, I was back in the car, looking like a grown-up, or so I hoped. The Rio Vista Convalescent Hospital was set in the middle of a residential area, an old 2-story stucco building painted a tarnished-looking Navajo white. The property was surrounded by chain-link fence, wide gates standing open onto a parking lot. The place didn't look like any hospital I'd ever seen. The grounds were flat, unlandscaped, largely sealed over in cracked asphalt on which cars were parked. As I approached the main entrance, I could see that the brittle blacktop was limned with faded circles and squares of some obscure sort. It wasn't until I'd passed through the main doors and was standing in the foyer that I knew what I'd been looking at. A playground. This had once been a grade school. The lines had been laid out for foursquare and tetherball. The interior was nearly identical to the elementary school I'd attended. High ceilings, wood floors, the sort of lighting fixtures that look like small, perfect moons. Across from me, a water fountain was still mounted on the wall. White porcelain with shiny chrome handles down low at kitty height. Even the air smelled the same, like vegetable soup. For a moment, the past was palpable, laid over reality like a sheet of cellophane, blocking out everything. I experienced the same rush of anxiety I'd suffered every day of my youth. I hadn't liked school. I'd always been overwhelmed by the dangers I sensed. Grade school was perilous. There were endless performances. Tests in spelling, geography, and math, homework assignments, pop quizzes, and workbooks. Every activity was judged and criticized, graded and reviewed. The only subject I liked was music, because you could look at the book, though sometimes, of course, you were compelled to stand up and sing all by yourself, which was death. The other kids were even worse than the work itself. I was small for my age, always vulnerable to attack. My classmates were sly and treacherous, given to all sorts of wicked plots they learned from TV. And who would protect me from their villainy? Teachers were no help. If I got upset, they would stoop down to my level, and their faces would fill my field of vision like rogue planets about to crash into Earth. Looking back on it, I can see how I must have worried them. I was the kind of kid who, for no apparent reason, wept piteously or threw up on myself. On an especially scary day, I sometimes did both. By fifth grade, I was in trouble almost constantly. I wasn't rebellious. I was too timid for that. But I did disobey the rules. After lunch, for instance, I would hide in the girls' restroom instead of going back to class. I longed to be expelled, imagining somehow that I could be free of school forever if they'd just kick me out. All my behavior netted me were trips to the office, or endless hours in a little chair placed in the hall. A public scourging, in effect. My aunt would swoop down on the principal, an avenging angel raising six kinds of hell that I should be subjected to such abuse. Actually, the first time I got the hall penalty, I was mortified. But after that, I liked it pretty well. It was quiet. I got to be alone. Nobody asked me questions or made me write on the board. Between classes, the other kids hardly looked at me, embarrassed on my behalf. "Miss?" I glanced up. A woman in a nurse's uniform was staring at me. I focused on my surroundings. I could see now that the corridor was populated with wheelchairs. Everyone was old and broken and bent. Some stared dully at the floor, and some made mewing sounds. One woman repeated endlessly the same quarrelsome request. "Someone let me out of here. Someone let me up. Someone let me out of here." "I'm looking for Agnes Gray."
"Patient or employee?"
"A patient. At least she was a couple of months back."
"Try administration."
She indicated the offices to my right. I collected myself, blanking out the sight of the feeble and infirm. Maybe life is just a straight shot from the horrors of grade school to the horrors of the nursing home. The administration offices were housed in makeshift quarters where the principal's office had probably been once upon a time. A portion of the large central hallway had been annexed and was now enclosed in glass, providing a small reception area, which was furnished with a wooden bench. I waited at the counter until a woman emerged from the inner office with an armload of files. She caught sight of me and veered in my direction with a public relations smile.
"May I help you?"
"I hope so," I said. "I'm looking for a woman named Agnes Gray. I understand she was a patient here a few months ago." The woman hesitated briefly and then said,
"May I ask what this is in connection with?"
I took a chance on the truth, never guessing how popular I was going to be as a consequence. I gave her my card and then recited my tale of Irene Gersh and how she'd asked me to determine her mother's whereabouts, ending with the oft-repeated query, "Do you happen to know where she is at this point?" She blinked at me for a moment. Some interior process caused a transformation in her face, but I hadn't the faintest idea how it related to my request.
"Would you excuse me, please?"
"Sure." She moved into the inner office and emerged a moment later with a second woman, who introduced herself as Mrs. Elsie Haynes, administrator of the facility. She was probably in her 60s, rotund, with a hairstyle that was whisker short along the neck and topped by a toupee of ginger-colored curls. This made her face appear too large for her head. She was, however, smiling at me most pleasantly.
"Miss Milhone, how very nice," she said, holding out her hands.
The handshake consisted of her making a hand sandwich with my right hand as the lunch meat.
"I'm Mrs. Haynes, but you must call me Elsie. Now, how can we be of help?"
This was worrisome. I usually don't get such receptions in my line of work. Nice to meet you, I said. I'm trying to locate a woman named Agnes Gray. I understand she was transferred here from Pioneers.
That's correct. Mrs. Gray has been with us since early March. I'm sure you want to see her, so I've asked the floor supervisor to join us. She'll take you up to Mrs. Gray's room.
Great, I'd appreciate that. Frankly, I didn't expect to find her here. I guess I thought she'd be out by now. Is she doing okay?
Oh, my, yes. She's considerably better.
Quite well.
But we have been concerned about continued care. We can't release a patient who has no place to go.
As nearly as we can tell, Mrs. Gray doesn't have a permanent address, and she's never admitted to having any next of kin.
We're delighted to hear that she has relatives living in the state. I'm sure you'll want to notify Mrs. Gersh and make arrangements to have her transferred to a comparable facility in Santa Teresa.
Ah, I felt myself nodding. Her Medi-Cal benefits were running out. I tried a public relations smile of my own, unwilling to commit Irene Gersh to anything.
I'm not sure what Mrs. Gersh will want to do. I told her I'd call as soon as I found out what was going on. She'll probably need to talk to you before she makes any decisions, but I'm assuming she'll ask me to drive Agnes back to Santa Teresa with me.
She and her assistant exchanged a quick look. Is there a problem with that?
Well, no, she said.
Her gaze shifted to the doorway.
Here's Mrs. Rehnquist, the ward supervisor. I think she's the person you should properly discuss this with.
We went through another round of introductions and explanations. Mrs. Rehnquist was perhaps 45, thin and tanned, with a wide, good-natured mouth and the dusky, lined complexion of a smoker. Her dark auburn hair was pulled back in a knot shaped like a donut, probably supported by one of those squishy nylon devices they sell at Woolworth's. The three women seemed to hover about me like secular nuns, full of murmurs and reassurances. Within minutes, Mrs. Rehnquist and I were out in the corridor, heading toward the ward. Chapter 5. I heard Agnes Gray before I ever laid eyes on her. Mrs. Rehnquist and I had climbed the wide curving stairs to the second floor. We proceeded down the upper hallway without saying much. The character of the grade school was still oddly evident, in spite of the fact that extensive remodeling had been done to accommodate current use. The former classrooms had been quite large, with wide, multi-paned windows stretching almost ceiling to floor. Light streamed in through glass embedded with chicken wire. The woodwork had been left in its original state, varnished oak aged to a glossy russet shade. Up here, the worn wood floors had been covered with mottled white vinyl tiles, and the once spacious rooms had been partitioned into cubicles, containing two beds each. The walls were painted in shades of pale green and blue. The place was clean, if impersonal, the air perfumed with intimate body functions gone sour. Old people were visible everywhere, in beds, in wheelchairs, on gurneys, huddled on hard wooden benches in the wide corridor, idle, insulated from their surroundings by senses that had shut down over the years. They seemed as motionless as plants, resigned to infrequent watering. Anyone would wither under such a regimen. No exercise, no air, no sunlight. They had outlived not only friends and family, but most illnesses, so that at 80 and 90 they seemed untouchable, singled out to endure, without relief, a life that stretched into yawning eternity. We passed a crafts room where 6 women sat around a table making potholders out of nylon loops woven on red metal frames. Their efforts were as misshapen as mine had been when I was 5. I never liked doing that shit the first time around, and I didn't look forward to having to do it again at the end of my days. Maybe I'd get lucky and be struck down by a beer truck before I was forced into such ignominy. Was evidently just ahead, as I'd picked up the blast of a television set turned up loud enough for failing ears, a PBS documentary by the sound of it. The banging and shrieking suggested tribal rites somewhere in a culture not given to quietude. We turned left into a 6-bed ward where a series of curtains were all that separated one patient from the next. At the far end of the room, like the origins of the Nile, I could see the source of the uproar. It wasn't a television set at all. Without even asking, I knew this was Agnes. She was stark naked, dancing a dirty boogie on the bed while she accompanied herself by banging on a bedpan with a spoon. She was tall and thin, bald everywhere except her bony head, which was enveloped in an aureole of wispy white fuzz. Malnutrition had distended her belly, leaving her long limbs skeletal. The lower portion of her face had collapsed on itself, jaw drawn up close to her nose in the absence of intervening teeth. She had no visible lips, and the truncated shape of her skull gave her the look of some long-legged, gangly bird with a gaping beak. She was squawking like an ostrich, her bright black eyes snapping from point to point. The minute she caught sight of us, she fired the bedpan in our direction like a heat-seeking missile. She seemed to be having the time of her life. A nurse's aide, maybe 20 years old, stood by helplessly. Clearly her training had never prepared her for the likes of this one. Mrs. Rehnquist approached Agnes matter-of-factly, pausing only once to pat the hand of the woman in the next bed, who seemed to be praying feverishly for Jesus to take her very soon. Meanwhile, Agnes, having asserted herself, was content to march around on the bed covers, saluting the other patients. To me, it looked like a wonderful form of indoor exercise. Her behavior seemed far healthier than the passivity of her ward-mates, some of whom simply lay in moaning misery. Agnes had probably been a hell-raiser all her life, and her style in old age hadn't changed a whit. "You have a visitor, Mrs. Gray."
"What?"
"You have a visitor." Agnes paused, peering at me. Her tongue crept into view and then disappeared again.
"Who's this?"
Her voice was hoarse from screeching. Mrs. Rehnquist held out a hand to her, helping Agnes down off the bed. The nurse's aide took a clean gown from the nightstand. Mrs. Rehnquist shook it out and draped it around Agnes's scrawny shoulders, pushing her arms into the sleeves. Agnes submitted with the complacence of a baby, her rheumy-eyed attention still focused on me. Her skin was speckled with color, pale brown maculae, patches of rose and white, knotty blue veins, crusty places where healing cuts formed fiery lines of red. The epidermal tissue was so thin I half expected to see the pale gray shapes of internal organs, like those visible on a newly hatched bird. What is it about aging that takes us right back to birth? She smelled sooty and dense, a combination of dried urine and old gym socks. Right away I started revising the notion of driving back to Santa Teresa in the same tiny car with her. The aide excused herself with a murmur and made a hasty getaway. I held out a hand politely. "Hello, Agnes. I'm Kinsey Milhone."
"Huh?"
Mrs. Rehnquist leaned close to Agnes and hollered my name so loud that two other old ladies on the ward woke up and began to make quacking sounds.
"Kinsey Milhone! She's a friend of your daughter's."
Agnes drew back, giving me a suspicious look.
"Who?"
"Irene," I yelled.
"Who asked you?"
Agnes shot back peevishly. She began to work her lips mechanically, as if tasting something she'd eaten 50 years before. Mrs. Rehnquist repeated the information, enunciating with care. I could see Agnes withdraw. A veil of simplicity seemed to cover her bright gaze, and she launched abruptly into a dialogue with herself that made no sense whatever.
"Keep hush. Do not say a word." "Well, I can if I want." "No, you can't." "Danger, danger. Ooh, hush, plenty, plenty. Don't even give a hint."
She began a warbling rendition of Goodnight, Irene. Mrs. Rehnquist rolled her eyes, and a short, impatient sigh escaped.
"She pulls this when she doesn't feel like doing what you want," she said. "She'll snap out of it."
We waited for a moment. Agnes had added gestures, and her tone was argumentative. She'd adopted the quarrelsome air of someone in a supermarket express line when the customer at the register tries to cash a paycheck. Whatever universe she'd been transported to, it did not include us. I drew Mrs. Rehnquist aside and lowered my voice. "Why don't we leave her alone for the time being?" I said. "I'm going to have to put a call through to Mrs. Gersh anyway and ask her what she wants done. There's no point in upsetting her mother any more than we have to."
"Well, it's whatever you want," Mrs. Rehnquist said. "She's just being ornery. Do you want to use the office phone?"
"I'll call from the motel." "Be sure we know how to get in touch with you," she said, with a faint note of uneasiness. I could see a hint of panic in her eyes at the notion that I might leave town without making arrangements for Agnes's removal.
I'll leave the motel number with Mrs. Haynes. I drove back to the Vagabond, where I put in a call first to Sergeant Pokris at the Sheriff's Department, advising her that Agnes Gray had indeed turned up. Then I placed the call to Irene Gersh and filled her in on her mother's circumstances. My report was greeted with dead silence. I waited, listening to her breathe in my ear.
"I suppose I better talk to Clyde," she said finally.
She did not sound happy at having to do this, and I could only imagine what Clyde's reaction would be. "What do you want me to do in the meantime?" I asked.
"Just stay there, if you would. I'll give Clyde a call at the office and get back to you as soon as possible. But it probably won't be till around supper time. I'd appreciate it if you'd drive back out to the slabs and put a padlock on Mother's door."
"What good is that going to do?" I said. "The minute I'm gone, the little turds will break in. The louvers in one window are already gone. Frustrate these kids, and they'll tear the place apart."
"It sounds like they've already done that."
"Well, true, but there's no point making life any more difficult."
"I don't care. I hate the idea of trespassers, and I won't abandon the place. She may still have personal belongings on the premises. Besides, she might want to go back when she's feeling like herself again. Did you talk to the sheriff? Surely there's some way to patrol the area."
"I don't see how. You know the situation better than I do. You'd have to have an armed guard to keep squatters out, and what's the point? The trailer's already been trashed."
"I want it locked," she said with an unmistakable edge.
"I'll do what I can," I said, making no attempt to disguise my skepticism.
"Thank you."
I gave her the telephone number at the Vagabond, and she said she'd get in touch with me later on. I changed back into jeans and tennis shoes, hopped in the car, and headed over to a hardware store, where I bought an oversized padlock of cartoon proportions that weighed about 3 pounds. The clerk assured me it would take a blasting cap to pop it off the hasp. What hasp, I thought. While I was at it, I bought the whole mechanism, hinged metal fastening and the corresponding staple, along with the tools to install the damn thing. Nothing was going to keep those kids out. I'd seen at least 2 holes punched into the trailer shell. All they'd have to do was enlarge one, and they could crawl in and out like rats. On the other hand, I was getting paid to do this, so what did I care? I picked up some nails and a couple of pieces of scrap lumber and returned to my car. I drove north on 111, doing the 18-mile return trip to the slabs. Offhand, I couldn't recall the name of the road I was looking for, so I kept my speed down and spent a lot of time peering off to my right. I passed a grove of date palms on my left. Beyond, in the far distance, I could see the vivid green of fields under cultivation. Somehow the countryside looked different, but it wasn't until I spotted the sign reading Salton Sea Recreation Area that I realized how far I'd overshot the mark. The road to the slabs had to be 10 miles back. I spotted a gravel side road ahead on the left, and I figured it was as good a place as any to make the turnaround. An old high-sided truck was approaching, kicking up a trail of dust, in spite of the fact it was only moving 10 miles an hour. I slowed for the turn, checking my rearview mirror. A red pickup truck was barreling down on me, but the driver must have noted my change in speed. He veered right, cutting around me as I gunned the engine, scooting out of his path. I heard the faint pop of a rock being crushed under my wheel, but it wasn't until I'd done the U-turn and was back on 111 that I felt the sudden roughness in the ride. The flap-flap-flapping sound warned me that one of my back tires was flat. "Oh, great," I said. Clearly I'd run over something more treacherous than a rock. I pulled over to the side of the road and got out. I circled my car. The rim of my right rear wheel was resting on the pavement, the tire forming a flabby rubber puddle underneath. It must have been 5 or 6 years since I'd changed a tire, but the principles probably hadn't changed. Take the jack out of the trunk, crank the sucker till the weight is lifted off the wheel, remove the hubcap, struggle with the lug nuts, pull the bad wheel off and set it aside while you heft the good one into place. Then replace all the lug nuts and tighten them before you jack the car down again. I opened my trunk and checked my spare, which was looking a bit soggy in itself. I wrestled it out and bounced it on the pavement. Not wonderful, but I decided it would get me as far as the nearest service station, which I remembered seeing a few miles down the road. This is why I jog and bust my hump lifting weights, so I can cope with life's little inconveniences. At least I wasn't wearing heels and pantyhose, and I didn't have glossy fingernails to wreck in the process.
Meanwhile, the flatbed had turned out onto the highway and had come to a stop 100 yards behind me. A dozen male farm workers hopped off the back of the truck and rearranged themselves. They seemed amused at my predicament and called out suggestions in an alien tongue. I couldn't really translate, but I got the gist. I didn't think they were giving any actual pointers on how to change a flat. They seemed like a good-natured bunch, too weary from the short hoe to do me any harm. I rolled my eyes and waved at them dismissively. This netted me a wolf whistle from a guy grabbing his crotch. I tuned them out and set to work, cussing like a stevedore as the flatbed pulled away. At times like this I tend to talk to myself, coaching myself through. It was mid-afternoon and the sun was beating down on me. The air was dry, the quiet unbroken. I don't know the desert well. To my untutored eye, the landscape seemed unpopulated. At ground level, where I sat wielding my crescent wrench, all I could see was a dead mesquite tree a few feet away. I've been told that if you listen closely, you can hear the clicks of the wood-boring beetles that tunnel through the dead wood to lay their eggs. I settled down to work, letting the isolation envelop me. Little by little, I became accustomed to the stillness in the same manner that eyes become accustomed to the dark. I picked up the drone of an occasional insect and noticed then the foraging warblers catching bugs on the fly. The true citizens of the Mojave emerge from their lairs by night. Rattlesnakes and lizards, jackrabbits, quail, the owl and the Harris hawk, the desert fox and the ground squirrel, all searching for prey, angling to eat each other in a relentless predatory sequence that begins with the termites and ends with the coyote. This is not a place I'd want to unroll my sleeping bag and lay my little head down. The sun spiders alone will scare you out of 10 years' growth. By 3:20, I'd successfully completed the task. I rolled the flat tire around to the front of the car so I could hoist it into my trunk. I could hear a foreign body rattle around inside, a rock or a nail by the sound of it. I checked for the puncture, running my fingers around the circumference of the tire. The hole was in the sidewall, a ragged perforation not quite the size of my little fingertip. I blinked at it, feeling chilled, not wanting to believe my eyes. It looked like a bullet hole. An involuntary sound escaped as I was overtaken by one of those rolling shudders you experienced as a kid on leaving a dark room. I lifted my head. I surveyed the countryside. No one, nothing. Not another car in sight. I wanted out of there. I hoisted the tire and shoved it into my trunk. Swiftly, I gathered the jack and my crescent wrench, moved around to the driver's side, and got in. I started the engine and rammed into gear, pulling back onto the highway. I drove faster than I should have, given the condition of my spare, but I didn't like the idea of being out there by myself. It had to have been the guy in the pickup truck. He'd passed me just as the blowout occurred. Of course, a rock might have caused the damage, but I couldn't think how it could have penetrated the sidewall, leaving such a nice, neat hole in its wake. The first service station I passed was out of business. The gas pumps were still standing, but the windows were broken and graffiti and a garland had been sprayed along the foundation. Local advertisers were using the supporting columns for their poster art, and a real estate company announced in bold print that the property could be leased. Fat chance. On the outskirts of Nyland, at the intersection of Main Street and the Salton Highway, I found a small station selling one of those peculiar brands of gasoline that make your car engine burp. I put some air in the spare tire and dropped off the flat. "I've got some business to take care of at the slabs," I said. "Any way you can do this in the next hour and a half?" He studied the tire. The look he gave me suggested that he'd come to the same conclusion I had, but he made no comment. He said he'd pull the tire off the rim and have it patched by the time I returned. I was guessing I'd be back by 5 o'clock. I didn't want to imagine myself out in the desert once the sun went down. I gave him a 10 for his trouble and told him I'd pay for the repair when I got back. I hopped in my car and then leaned my head out in his direction. "Where's the road to the slabs?"
"You're on it," he said.
I took Main to the point where it becomes Beale Road, approaching Slab City this time with a sense of familiarity. I felt safer out here. There seemed to be more people at this hour. An RV pulling into a site, kids being dropped off in a snub-nosed yellow school bus. Now the dogs were out, leaping joyously at the sight of all the children home from school. When I reached rusted-out Chevy Road, I turned right, and soon Agnes Gray's blue trailer appeared just ahead. I parked short of the place and pulled my tools out of the back seat.
Thoroughly paranoid by now, I took out my little Davis semi-automatic and tucked it into the waistband of my blue jeans at the small of my back. I grabbed an old cotton shirt and pulled it on over my T-shirt, gathered up the lumber, the padlock, and the latch, and approached the trailer on foot. The gremlins were in residence. I could hear the murmur of their voices. I reached the front door, unable to avoid the gravel crunching underfoot. The voices were silenced instantly. I leaned against the frame, peering in at an angle. For all I knew, I'd get whacked with a 2x4. Instead, I found myself face to face with the dreadlocked creature I'd spied earlier that day. A second scummy face appeared beside the first. I'd been informed by the neighbors that one was the boy chick and one was the girl. I was guessing this one to be male, but I truly couldn't discern any sex-based differences. Neither had facial hair. Both were young, with the unformed features of cherubs, tatty mops on top, ragged clothes below. Neither smelled any better than Agnes had. The boy and I eyed each other and swelled up in the manner of apes. So ludicrous. We were both the same size. 5'6", neither one of us over 120 pounds. Little banty-weight toughs. One possible difference was that I was willing to kick the shit out of him, and I didn't think he was prepared to do likewise. With a glance at his companion, he rocked back on his heels, hands in his pockets as if he had all day. He said, "Hey, poopsie, what the fuck are you doing here?" I felt my temper flash. My nerves were already on edge, and I didn't need any aggravation from a little punk like him. "I own this place, ass-eyes," I said snappishly.
"Oh, really? Let's see you prove it."
"No problem, poopsie. I've got the deed of trust." I pulled the gun out of my waistband and held it with the barrel up. It wasn't loaded, but it looked good. If I'd had my old Colt, I could have cocked it for effect. I freely confess, while I can intimidate little boys, I'm not that good with the grown ones. "Get lost," I said. The two of them fell all over each other, trying to scramble out the back. The trailer shook with their trampling feet, and then they were gone. I ambled down the passageway and peered into the bathroom. As I suspected, they were using a hole in the wall as an emergency exit. The first thing I did was board up their escape route, pounding nail after nail into the flimsy bathroom wall. Then I used a handheld drill to set the screw holes for the hasp I was mounting. I can't say I worked with any astonishing skill, but I got the job done, and the physical labor improved my mood. It felt good to smash things. It felt good to sweat. It felt good to be in control of one small corner of the universe. As long as I was here, I did a quick search, looking to see if there was anything of old Mama's left. I couldn't find a thing. The cupboards were bare, closets stripped, the various nooks and crannies emptied of her possessions. Most of them had probably been sold at the flea market on the road coming in. I went out to the VW and snagged the 35mm camera I keep in the rear wall. I had part of a roll of film left, and I snapped off as many photos of the place as I could. I didn't think Irene Gersh was going to get it otherwise. She had talked as if her mother might retire here in her golden years. Before I popped the padlock into place, I bundled up the gremlin sleeping bags and miscellaneous belongings and left them by the front step. Then I went across the road and told Marcus what I'd done. As I returned to the trailer, I spotted a slice of crawl space underneath, makeshift storage, where a few items had been crammed. I got down on my hands and knees, reaching back among the bugs and spiders, and pulled out a couple of dilapidated cardboard boxes. One was open and contained a motley collection of rusted garden tools, trowels, a spade, a short hoe. The second box had the top flaps closed, sections interlocked to secure the contents without anything actually being sealed shut. I pulled the flaps back and checked inside. The box contained numerous pieces of china wrapped in newspaper, a child's tea set. It didn't even look like a full set to me, but I thought Irene or her mother might like to take a look. Certainly I wasn't eager to leave the dishes for the gremlins to raid. I closed the box up again. I snapped the padlock shut on the trailer door. I had no hope whatever of keeping the little buggers at bay, but I'd tagged the necessary bases. I toted the box to my car and shoved it in the back seat. It was still light when I left the slabs, but by the time I picked up my tire and headed back into Brawley, it was fully dark. In my pocket was the .38 slug the mechanic had removed from the tire. I really wasn't sure what it signified, but as I'm keenly aware of the obvious, I had a fair idea. Chapter 6. I went back to the Vagabond and got cleaned up. I made a wad of my overshirt and tucked it in the duffel, pulled on a fresh T-shirt and buckled on my shoulder rig. I put my briefcase on the bed beside me while I took out a box of PMC cartridges and loaded my .32, which I tucked snugly under my left arm. A threat on your life is a curious thing. It seems, at the same time, both abstract and absurd. I didn't have any reason to disbelieve the facts. I was on Tyrone Patty's hit list. Some guy in a pickup had shot out my tire on an isolated stretch of road. Now, it could have been a wholly unrelated prank, but I suspect if the flatbed full of farm workers hadn't pulled up behind me, the guy in the pickup might have circled back and plugged me. God! Saved by a truckload of Mexicans making obscene digital remarks. I might have been abducted or killed outright. Instead, providentially, I was still in one piece. What I was having trouble with was figuring out what to do next. I knew better than to go to the local cops. I couldn't tell them the make, the model, or the license number of the truck itself, and I hadn't gotten a good look at the driver's face. Under the circumstances, the cops might sympathize, but I didn't see what they could offer in the way of help. Like the Santa Teresa police, they'd be long on concern and short on solutions. What then? One alternative was to pack my car and head back to Santa Teresa toot sweet. On the other hand, it didn't seem smart to be out on the road at night, especially in territory like this, where it was possible to drive for 10 miles without seeing a light. My friend in the pickup had already tried for me once. Better not offer him a second opportunity. Another possibility was to put a call through to the Nevada Private Eye and ask for some help. The community of private investigators is actually a small one, and we're protective of one another. If anyone could offer me assistance, it would be someone who played the same game I did with the same kind of stakes. While I prided myself on my independence, I'm not a fool, and I'm not afraid to ask for backup when the situation calls for it. That's one of the first things you learn as a cop. In a curious way, this still didn't feel like an emergency. The jeopardy was real, but I couldn't seem to make it connect to my personal safety. I knew in my head the danger was out there, but it didn't feel dangerous, a distinction that might prove deadly if I didn't watch my step. I knew I'd be wise to take the situation seriously, but I couldn't for the life of me work up a sweat. People in the early stages of a terminal illness must react the same way. You're kidding, who, me? After the phone call from Irene Gersh, I'd have to come up with a game plan. In the meantime, as I was starving, I decided I might as well grab a bite of supper. I zipped on a windbreaker, effectively concealing the shoulder holster and the gun. On the far side of the road was a cafe with a blinking neon sign that said, "Eat and get gas." Just what I needed. I crossed the highway carefully, looking to both sides like a kid. Every vehicle I saw seemed to be a red pickup truck. The cafe was small. The lighting was harsh, but it had a comforting quality. After years of horror movies, I'm inclined to believe bad things only happen in the dark. Silly me. I elected to sit against the rear wall, as far from the plate glass window as I could get. There were only 6 other patrons, and they all seemed to know each other. Not one of them seemed sinister. I studied a clear plastic menu with a slip-in mimeographed sheet reproduced in a blur of purple ink. The items seemed equally divided between cholesterol and fat. This was my kind of place. I ordered a deluxe cheeseburger platter, which included French fries and a lily pad of lettuce with a slice of gas-ripened tomato laid over it. I had a large Coke and topped it all off with a piece of cherry pie that made me moan aloud. This was the cherry pie of my childhood, tart and gluey with a lattice top crust welded in place with blackened sugar. It looked like it had been baked with an acetylene torch. The meal left me in a chemical stupor. I figured I'd just consumed enough additives and preservatives to extend my life by a couple of years, if I didn't get killed first. On the way back to my room, I stopped by the motel office to see if there were any messages. There were 2 from the convalescent home and a 3rd from Irene, who had called about 10 minutes before. All 3 were marked urgent. Oh, boy! I tucked the slips into my pocket and headed out the door. Once out on the walkway, I stopped dead in my tracks, struck by the eerie sensation that I was being watched. A silvery feeling traveled my body from head to toe, as chilling as a trickle of melting snow down the back of my neck. I was acutely aware of the glowing windows behind me. I eased out of range of the exterior lights and paused in the shadows. The parking lot was poorly illuminated, and my motel room was at the far end. I listened, but all I could hear were the noises from the highway. The whine of trucks, the sonorous blast from a speeding semi warning vehicles in its path. I wasn't sure what had alerted me, if anything. I peered into the dark, turning my head from side to side, eyes averted as I tried to pinpoint discrete sounds against the obliterating fog of background noise. I waited, heart thumping in my ears. I didn't like what this business was doing to my head. Faintly, I picked up the musical tinkling of a little kid giggling somewhere. The tone was impish, high-pitched, the helpless snuffling of someone being tickled unmercifully. I sank down on my heels beside a wall of thick shrubbery. A man appeared from the far end of the parking lot, walking toward me through the shadows with a kid perched on his shoulders. He had his arms raised, in part to secure the child, in part to torment him, digging the fingers of one hand into his ribs. The kid clung to the man, laughing, fingers buried in his hair, his body swaying in a tempo with his father's walking pace, like a rider mounted on a camel. The man ducked as the two of them turned into a lighted passageway, an alcove where I'd seen the soft drink and ice machines. A moment later, I heard the familiar clunking sound of a can of soda plummeting down the slot. The two emerged, this time, hand in hand, chatting companionably. I let my breath out, watching them round the corner to the exterior stairs. They appeared again on the second floor, where they entered the third room from the end. End of episode. I wasn't even aware that I'd taken my gun out, but my jacket was unzipped and it was in my hand. I stood upright, tucking my gun away. My heartbeat slowed and I shook some of the tension out of my arms and legs, like a runner at the end of an arduous race. I returned to my room along the narrow drive that ran behind the motel. It was very dark, but it felt safer than traversing the open parking lot. I cut around the end of the building and unlocked my door, reaching around to flip the light on before I slipped inside. The room was untouched, everything exactly as I'd left it. I locked the door behind me and closed the drapes. When I sat down beside the bed table and picked up the telephone, I realized my underarms were damp with sweat, the fear like the aftershock of an earthquake. It took a moment for my hands to quit shaking. I called Irene first. She picked up instantly, as if she'd been hovering by the telephone. "Oh, Kinsey, thank God," she said when I identified myself. "You sound upset. What's going on?"
"I got a call from the convalescent home about an hour ago. I had a long chat with Mrs. Haynes earlier this afternoon, and we've made arrangements to have Mother flown up by air ambulance. Clyde has gone to a great deal of trouble to get her into a nursing home up here. Really, it's a lovely place and quite close to us. I thought she'd be thrilled, but when Mrs. Haynes told her about it, she went berserk, absolutely out of control. She had to be sedated, and even so, she's raising hell. Somebody's got to go over there and get her calmed down. I hope you don't mind."
Hell, I thought. "Well, I don't want to argue, Irene, but I can't believe I'd be of any help. Your mother hasn't the faintest idea who I am, and furthermore, she doesn't care. When she saw me this afternoon, she threw a bedpan across the room."
"I'm sorry, I know it's a nuisance, but I'm at my wit's end. I tried talking to her myself by phone, but she's incoherent. Mrs. Haynes says sometimes the medication has that effect. Instead of calming these older patients down, it just seems to rev them up. They have a private duty nurse driving up from El Centro for the 11 o'clock shift, but meanwhile the ward's in an uproar and they're begging for help."
God. "All right, I'll do what I can, but I don't have any training in this kind of thing."
"I understand," she said. "I just don't know who else to ask."
I told her I'd head on over to the hospital, and then I hung up. I couldn't believe I'd been roped into this. My presence on a geriatric ward was going to prove about as effective as the padlock on the trailer door. All form, no content. What really bugged me was the suspicion that nobody would have even suggested that a boy detective do likewise. I didn't want to see that old lady again. While I admired her spunk, I didn't want to be in charge of her. I had my own ass to worry about. Why does everybody assume women are so nurturing? My maternal instincts were extinguished by my Betsy Wetsy doll. Every time she peed in her little flannel dighties, I could feel my temper climb. I quit feeding her, and that cured it. But it did make me wonder, even at the age of 6, how suited I was for motherhood. It was in this charitable frame of mind that I proceeded to the Rio Vista. I drove with an eye to my rear-view mirror to see if anyone was following. I watched for pickup trucks of every color and size. I thought the one I'd seen was a Dodge, but I hadn't been paying close attention at the time, and I couldn't have sworn to it. Nothing untoward occurred. I reached the convalescent hospital, parked my car in a visitor's slot, walked back through the front entrance, and headed for the stairs. It was ominously quiet. No telling what Agnes was up to. It was only 8:00 p.m., but the floor lights had already been dimmed, and the facility was bathed in the muted rustle and hush of any hospital at night. The old sleep restlessly, pained limbs crying out. Nights must be long, filled with fretful dreams, the fear of death, or worse perhaps, the certainty of waking up to another interminable day. What did they have to hope for? What ambitions could they harbor in this limbo of artificial light? I could sense the hiss of oxygen in the walls, the pull of the pharmaceuticals with which their bodies were infused. Hearts would go on beating, lungs would pump, kidneys filtering all the poisons from the blood. But who would diagnose their feelings of dread, and how would anyone provide relief from the underlying malady, which was despair? When I reached the ward, I could see that Agnes's bed was the only one with a light. A male aide, a young black, set his magazine aside and tiptoed in my direction with a finger to his lips. We spoke briefly in low tones. The medication had finally kicked in, and she was dozing, he said. Now that I was here, he had his regular duties to attend to. If I needed anything, I could find him at the nurse's station down the hall. He moved out of the room. I crossed quietly to the pool of bright light in which Agnes slept. The counterpane on her bed was a heavyweight cotton, harsh white, her thin frame scarcely swelling the flat coverlet. She snored softly. Her eyes seemed to be opened slightly, lids twitching as she tracked some interior event. Her right hand clutched at the sheet, her arthritic knuckles as protuberant as redwood burls. Her chest was flat. Coarse whiskers sprouted from her chin, as if old age were transforming her from one sex to the other. I found myself holding my breath as I watched her, willing her to breathe, wondering if she'd sail away right before my eyes. This afternoon she'd seemed sassy and energetic. Now she reminded me of certain old cats I've seen, whose bones seem hollow and small, who seem capable of levitating, so close are they to fairy-like.